This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on October 4th, 2012. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The next item on the agenda is the discussion of Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-32, Tea Party Leadership Fund. We have a presentation from Ms. Wallstriker and Mr. Backer. You're more than welcome to join us. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Hunter. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 1270 is a draft response to an advisory opinion request submitted by the Tea Party Leadership Fund, Sean Bialat, and John Race. Please note that this is an expedited advisory opinion request under Section 437FA2 of the Act. Under that section, an advisory opinion requested by a candidate within 60 days before the candidate's election must be issued by the Commission within 20 days after the complete request is received. And the 20-day deadline for the Commission to issue this advisory opinion request is a week from today, October 11th. The Tea Party Leadership Fund is a non-connected political committee. They registered with the Commission in May 2012. It represents that it has made contributions to seven candidates, including $2,500 each to Mr. Bialat and Mr. Race, and that it has received contributions from over 4,500 persons. Mr. Bialat is a candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives for Massachusetts' 4th Congressional District, and Mr. Race is a candidate for the U.S. Senate for West Virginia. The committee wishes to contribute an additional $2,500 each to Mr. Bialat and Mr. Race, which would exceed the contribution limits for persons other than multi-candidate political committees. The requesters ask whether the committee may make, and Mr. Bialat and Mr. Race may accept, contributions up to the higher limit for multi-candidate committees before the six-month period for qualifying as such a committee has elapsed. The draft concludes that at this time, the Act prohibits the Tea Party Leadership Fund from making, and Mr. Bialat and Mr. Race from accepting, contributions in excess of $2,500 per election. We received one comment on the request and two comments on the draft. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. And as noted, the 20-day deadline in this advisory opinion is Thursday, October 11th. Our next public meeting is October 18th, so we thought it prudent to have a public discussion on this request, although we will be accepting any written comments through the 10-day statutory comment period, which expires tomorrow, October 5th. And again, we will not vote on this today, but we wanted to have a public discussion before we vote on it. Any questions or comments for the Office of General Counsel or the requester, Mr. Backer? Commissioner McGann.
Since Mr. Backer's joined us, I'll ask him a few questions. We're not voting today because there's a 10-day rule, and there's a comment that brought that to our attention, albeit in a rather scratchy fashion, but we were aware of that before
the comment came in.
Right?
Yes, we were aware of that.
Right,
yes.
But we appreciate when people bring that stuff to our attention. The issue is it seems like you're challenging the multi-candidate PAC regime where you have to wait at least 6 months before you become a multi-candidate PAC, which is what the statute says. Right? It's not a creature of FEC regulation. This is a statutory question. And you filed comments that say correctly that administrative agencies can, when interpreting statutes and even their own regs, consider constitutional issues. There's a mountain of case law that says when we construe things, we can avoid constitutional doubt, that sort of thing. All of that's true. I'm not sure everyone at the commission, since it's opened its doors, agrees that it's as true as some of us think it is, but it's a matter of degree, not kind. But this is not a difference of degree. In this case, it seems more difference of kind. Even if we could construe the statute to avoid constitutional doubt, that's not what you're asking. It seems like you're asking us to say the statute's unconstitutional. So my question is, how does an agency get to do that if you're coming at us with two reads of the statute? One reading causes a constitutional problem because of a case or and the other doesn't, I could see saying I agree that we should take the course more certain and less fraught with constitutional problem. But that doesn't seem to be the question here. It seems to be there's one way to read the statute. I think we all agree there's one way to read the statute, and that way is unconstitutional, and the agency should say that. Am I misstating the question? And if I'm not misstating the question, how do I have the power to do that?
I would suggest that the question is a little narrower. It's not that the six-month prior restraint is unconstitutional on its face. It's unconstitutional as applied to this particular client committee, because as the commission notes in its blue draft, the statute exists purely to prevent circumvention of the contribution limits, which is a very legitimate government interest. But here, that the restriction is perhaps not narrowly drawn enough to permit activity that by an organization that on its face is clearly not a vehicle of anti-circumvention. It's when we filed this request, we had 4,500 contributors. I think we're north of 6,000 and change right now. This is an organization that is driven by small dollar donors, and to apply a statute that is expressly intended to prevent the circumvention of contribution limits by very wealthy individuals to an organization that clearly is in no way doing so, would seem to be unconstitutional as applied to this particular group. To the extent that the commission can take that into consideration, we would hope there would be a way to prevent this committee from being subject to penalty of law. Well, that this committee should probably not be subject to that particular restraint, or at a minimum, there should be a mechanism to allow a committee that is clearly not engaging in anti-circumvention activity to not be so restrained.
Merely because your client doesn't want to circumvent the limits and they're not going to use the PAC contribution limits to end run their own individual limits, I don't see how that gets us where we're going, because you could have someone, for example, who says the biannual limit ought not apply to me because I'm not trying to corrupt or create the appearance of corruption, right? I'm not looking to compromise or create the appearance of compromise of this member of Congress, so I should be able to give more than $2,500. Just because you're not trying to, right? Now, if you're saying that it just doesn't, this anti-circumvention thing just doesn't work anymore, I could see that perhaps in the future because the individual limits are tied to inflation and they raise and the PAC limits aren't. And at a certain point when an individual can give more than a PAC, it's hard to say that the PAC could then circumvent the limits, I suppose, without the waiting period, although I do see an argument that says you still could wait because it makes it a little bit more tougher to use a PAC to double your own limit or whatnot. But sitting here today, you still have limits that are different, and the individual limit is different than the PAC limit, and I still see that the anti-circumvention rationale still works sitting here today. And I don't understand how it doesn't work for your client, or why your client's different than everyone else.
I would suggest our client is no different than anybody else and ought to have the same ability to engage in multi-candidate political committee speech as the Teamsters Political Action Committee or GE's Political Action Committee, or a group of or any non-connected PAC that was organized a few days earlier than we were. I think the it's kind of an unfortunate way that the timing worked out, but for this organization, these close to 6,000-plus individuals to be denied the same speech rights as everybody else who's been around a few days longer seems to me the wrong outcome here. And I recognize that there is certainly a difficulty in finding a way to get to that result. But the contra is we see that there's a rule here. The rule as applied it generally makes a lot of sense. In this particular circumstance, it doesn't. And that, you know, there ought to be a way to not enforce a statute or not subject a committee to the penalties of violating a statute where the entire purpose and the express purpose of that statute is not at issue here. It's not that our client, this committee, does not intend to violate the multi-candidate is not intending to corrupt members of Congress. It's that as just a function of its existence and how it's evolved, it will not act to be a vehicle for circumvention. The argument would then be if this somehow were made possible, hundreds of donors would suddenly come to us with $5,000 contributions, and then that we would then, you know, accept these earmarked contributions and give them out to their favorite candidates. It's a bit of a stretch. It's a small organization.
It's earmarked, it would still be the individual limit.
Well, the
it's a PAC limit if it's earmarked through the PAC.
The improperly earmarked transactions. But my point is that the contra is, here's a statute that has applied to this particular organization of thousands of individuals. It simply denies them the same rights of free speech they would have if they associated in some other way. But they're choosing to associate this way. And where the rationale of the statute simply doesn't apply here, it would seem that enforcing the statute fully on this committee would lead to a bad outcome. Mm-hmm. And I think there ought to be a mechanism of, and maybe perhaps there isn't, but it seems to me there should be some way to prevent the rights of this group of individuals from being thrown under the bus for the benefit of what is certainly a legitimate government interest.
Let's assume all that's right. How does that get you an advisory opinion? I mean, is the advisory opinion process really, under the Act, designed to flesh out areas where you think the agency may have discretion? I mean, I think that's – my view is it's not. And I don't really know of an example of an AO where the agency has said the rule of law is X, but we're going to, in our discretion, not enforce on a particular requester because of, you know, burden or small change or de minimis or not a priority of the commission or all the other things the commission lists when they, you know, dismiss cases, you know, on the enforcement side. I just don't know how we do this in an AO because it still seems like really that's at least close. At least that's not you're asking us to declare the statute unconstitutional. But how do we do this in an AO? Is the AO really a proper vehicle for this?
And it may be that an AO is not a proper vehicle, but I think if you look at this in the historical context of when the law was passed and the amendments were passed and how it evolved, you can look at the weight of precedent and say, you know, this probably, you know, based on the rulings of the court, it would seem that in this case it is not constitutional as applied to this particular entity, and therefore there needs to be a remedy. Much in the same way that if you look at the Club for Growth AOR 2009, I believe 1109 or 11, sorry, 2010-09 or 2010-11, I forget which one, you had a string of very recent court cases that were very clearly on point that this commission looked at and said, well, look, based on this precedent, we have to issue this. I think here you've got a much, much longer 30-year history of cases that have where this issue has probably never come up before, but given the explosive growth of grassroots and outside actors in politics and political speech and the many new organizations that are out there, it's only now becoming an issue. And I think the issue is certainly not going to go away. It's going to be a bigger issue as time goes on, as more and more individuals enter the political speech arena. The system that probably made a lot of sense when it was first passed, but doesn't really comport to the string of cases and changes to the law, I think there's an opportunity to make some room here.
Oh, there absolutely is. And that's – we get in the cab and we go down to the place in the White Dome and we tell all this to them because that's really the place to go with a lot of the argument. On the one hand, you cite AOs that the commission, I think, correctly recognized that there was existing case law that called into doubt the premise of the issue in those AOs, and I think the commission is duty-bound to apply those cases, and the commission did in several of them, not all of them, but several of them. But then you say, but this is what your situation hasn't come up yet, and there really isn't a case, so because there isn't a case, therefore we should assume there might be a case someday, and just let's nip this all in the bud and just do it right here at the commission. You know, personally, maybe the 6 months is too long. Maybe it should be 3 months. Maybe it should be 5 months. Maybe it shouldn't be giving contributions to five candidates. Maybe it should be 10. Maybe it should be two. Maybe it should be three. Maybe having 50 contributors, maybe that's too many. Maybe that's not enough. We can debate that all day long if we were a legislature, but we're not. So I'm not sure what we can do here. I mean, if you want to do an as-applied challenge to the constitutionality of the Act, I don't see that the commission's empowered to do that, and that moves it to the other branch, not the White Dome, but a couple blocks away, around 4th, 5th Street, go there. And I'm not being flip. I'm just being conversational on this. I don't know what I can do. Even if I were to agree with you that it's odd that there's still this multi-pack deal, and once upon a time it made a lot of sense, and it's making less and less sense today, which maybe is true, I'm not sure what I can do, because what you don't have is a case, and maybe there is a case and we haven't gotten to it yet, meaning maybe it exists and we just haven't gotten to it in our discussion, that calls into question the regime that's on the books. I mean, this is not – it doesn't jump out to me that whether you look at Wisconsin Right to Life or Davis or Citizens United or Speech Now or Unity 08 or Emily's List or – even cases that concern state laws, recent Eighth Circuit decision, you know, I don't see the – it doesn't jump out at me that those give us the hook to construe the act in a way that doesn't reach what you're doing. I'm not hearing it here. If I'm missing it, I'm going to give you one more chance to explain it to me, but I'm not seeing what we can do other than to say we can't say yes that – the act doesn't apply to you in an AO context.
I keep thinking about this in a slightly different perspective. Hypothetically, if Congress were to pass an amendment to FECA that said all political committees must wait 6 months from the time they're registered before they're allowed to make any contributions whatsoever, I think everyone would agree that that's probably unconstitutional on its face. But if this were passed as statute and a matter came here, would the commission then feel bound to say, well, look, this is clearly unconstitutional. We can't sit here and say that we don't have the authority to not enforce this, that we have the duty to enforce a statute we think is clearly unconstitutional. And I think this is a very narrow area.
But that's not the case here. I don't see the parallel. I mean, that assumes you're going to have the entire Congress do something that's obviously unconstitutional and knowingly do it if it's that obvious and then kick it over here. I mean, I guess they could pass a law that says the FEC is to ensure that the currency is on the gold standard. Right? I mean, they could do a lot. It's give me something a little bit more tied to the facts of this case.
I think with specifically to this matter, you have a legitimate government interest. You have a narrowly drawn mechanism to protect that government interest. I think the mechanism is still sweeping in that conduct, which it ought to be permissible, into that prohibition. And it seems that there ought to be a way for an agency to recognize and address that without the necessity of, for example, going to another branch of government for redress. And perhaps there isn't a mechanism, but it would seem that putting that burden on speakers seems somewhat unreasonable.
Okay, I'll bite. This isn't obviously unconstitutional to me. Let's assume that the agency can and an AO say, yeah, you know, you're right. There's a problem here. I don't see the problem. You know, I'm not at all confident you go to court. I don't see this as a slam dunk winner for you in court. What am I missing there? Is it?
I'll read on the authorities and the case involved and the legislative and litigation history here. We think it probably would be a likely win in court simply because this is clearly a prior restraint.
Likely would be. I mean, that's – you really want me to go out on that limb with you?
Fair enough. We feel very strongly that as an attorney, I hate making absolute statements, we believe that this particular statute, as applied to our client, is unconstitutional because it is a prior restraint on speech that discriminates against speakers based on identity and timing. We think it doesn't survive constitutional muster as applied to this particular organization, and it seems unreasonable that speakers now have to go to court in order to address that concern. These issues. Rather than have an intermediate mechanism that would allow them to avoid the application of a statute that is applied to them as unconstitutional. I may be overreaching in that, though.
Wait a second. If someone wants to give to your PAC today, mm-hmm. they can give to the PAC today.
Yes.
Right. If they want to give to a candidate today, they can give to a candidate today.
Yes.
Right. The PAC, if it wants to give to a candidate today, can give to a candidate today.
Yes.
The difference is how much the PAC can give to a candidate.
Yes.
So when we talk about free speech of all these people, the PAC's a separate entity, right? The Supreme Court told us that in Citizens United, right? It has its own speech rights, if you will, mm-hmm. different from those of the individual. Is it the individual that's being compromised? Because if it is, then you sounds like then you are saying they can circumvent and get a little extra bonus on their individual limits by running money through a PAC. I don't think you're suggesting that.
No.
I don't see where you're going. I mean, I understand the idea of you have PACs being treated differently and there's language that says you can't treat speakers differently and all that. But for contribution limit purposes, courts have also upheld different contribution limits depending on all sorts of things. Every state has different limits for their state officials, for example. I mean, there's different reasons why there's different limits. I mean, some people are still banned from giving directly. So even in the federal system, different limits have been upheld. I'm just not seeing the slam dunk here that I just I'm not seeing. I'm not. Again, when if the contra, if there was some, I don't see the harm.
I think the harm is not just to the speech rights of the legal entity, but also to the associational rights of the thousands of people who are contributing to this entity because they agree with it, they share its values, they want to see the values of this entity promulgated. They're contributing in an associational context.
Right. But they can do that. Right? They can give.
But the value and the value of their support and the ability for that associational speech to have an impact is somehow less valuable than the rights of members of the Teamsters Union or the senior executives of General Electric. It seems to me that discriminating the multi-candidate, the six-month waiting period is on its face and expressly created as an anti-circumvention rationale or mechanism. And where you don't have circumvention going on and where you have these individuals who want to speak in the same or associate in the same way as GE executives or teams members of the Teamster or union members of the Teamsters, that according their association with less speech rights is somehow discriminatory to their interests. I certainly appreciate that there are differences in how much individuals may contribute and different contribution limits throughout the federal regime. But where you have this isn't a differentiation between two types of speakers. It's a differentiation between speakers based on how long they've wanted to speak and at what point they decided that they wanted to engage in association and political speech. I think that's the differentiation that's being made, and it's based on a legitimate government interest, but one that as applied to this particular situation and probably many more situations to come is unconstitutional. Okay. But again, perhaps the commission
just too much, and then I'll let it go. If I wanted to give to your PAC, how much could I give?
Right now, $5,000.
If I were a member of the Teamsters Union, and the Teamsters PAC solicited me, how much could I give to the Teamsters PAC?
$5,000.
Okay, so there's no difference there.
Not on the limit on the amount that they can contribute into their association.
Right.
So the value of that.
So my rights at this point, there's no discrimination there. Not being treated differently. You know, the only difference is from the PAC's perspective whether they can give $5,000 or $2,500. Right.
And I would argue that the ability of the political action committee, the differences in the ability of the PAC to contribute, necessarily implicates the ability of the speech and association rights of those contributing to the political action committee.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the commenter correctly pointed out, we're not going to vote on this today. My mind is still open. If anybody wants to file any additional comments before the end of the comment period, I'm happy to consider them. But I agree with the chair. Since this is the only open meeting that we were going to have before your answer is due, it's probably of some value for people to hear at least where we're leaning. And where I'm leaning is, Mr. Backer, it's a pleasure to see you. My regards to your colleague, Mr. Hursting. You're always welcome here, but I think you're in the wrong place. everything that you've said so far basically sounds to me like an as-applied constitutional challenge to the statute. Mere commissioners cannot afford you the relief that you seek. You need Article III judges for that. We can't strike down, either on a facial or an as-applied basis, we cannot strike down a provision of the law. And, you know, you could, it's true, you could go to Congress and lobby there for them to amend the law. I think a lot of people would like to see this law amended in a lot of different ways. Maybe you can get a coalition together, get some compromise going. That would be kind of cool. But we're not legislators, and we're not judges, and we can't strike down provisions of the law. We don't have a provision for issuing declaratory judgments that we would not enforce the law against you based on your constitutional concerns. I appreciate the authorities that you've cited and previous commissioners' statements that we should be sensitive to the Constitution, mindful of the Constitution. I like to think I'm a sensitive person, but I still can't strike down the law for you. So, and I also am sensitive to the fact that I know you in particular worry about administrative burdens and bureaucratic burdens. I would not wish you to think that you have an obligation to come here. I would not wish to. I think you're putting an administrative burden on yourself that you don't need. You don't need to be here. It sounds to me like you really want to sue over this law, and you're welcome to do so, but you don't need to come here first. You don't need our permission to sue us. You don't need an advisory opinion denying your request before you can go into court and say you think this is unconstitutional as applied to your client. If that's what you want to do, go forth. I don't wish to impose any additional delay or burden on that process. But I, you know, unless I get a comment in the next day or so that before the comment period runs that persuades me otherwise, it seems to me that we just can't give you what you're asking for.
Any other questions or comments, Commissioner Peterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I won't belabor the point, but the requester is correct that the commission can clearly consider constitutional principles and case law when making enforcement and decisions when interpreting and construing the statute. In this case, there's really not a provision that's ambiguous or vague that we have to construe. I mean, 6 months is 6 months, so. We're not in a situation where we need to look at competing interpretations and figure out which one may create constitutional problems and which ones may not. And this really does look more like directly as an as-applied challenge, and I think that there are limits on what the commission can do in this, especially in the advisory opinion context. You're absolutely right that in some other advisory opinions, Club for Growth, Common Sense 10, one the National Defense AO that you brought some time ago, where we had to consider the impact of the Emily's List case on your request and on existing statutory and regulatory provisions. But in this case, where we don't have an ambiguous statute, and as far as I can tell, we don't have the sort of intervening case law that we saw in those others, where we had Citizens United, Speech Now, Emily's List, that did create some rather large questions about the underlying viability of some of the provisions that were on the books. I think that as commissioners, our hands are somewhat tied in what we can do at this particular stage. In terms of the administrative burden, depending on the court, some you may actually have to tag this space before moving forward. Some might consider this an exhaustion of administrative remedies before you can take it to court. And so for that reason, I don't necessarily blame you for bringing this before the commission's attention. But we aren't making a decision today, but I do have that concern about what the commission can actually do in the AO context and what looks like an as-applied challenge.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Mr. Backer, for joining us this morning. We will give you an answer by the 20-day deadline, which, again, is Thursday, October 11th. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Commissioners.